Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
Exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you after a week off. It's a Monday, and it's my pleasure to provide a little honestly provocative talk radio. And on a Monday, I want to ask you this. The legislative special session for the state of Oregon begins on Friday. It is one of the biggest scam jobs that you have ever seen. And the first hearing for the public to be able to sound off about this crazy increase in taxes is going to be happening just about 3 hours from now. So let me give you fair warning about what is coming at you. Because the legislative regular session tried to pass a $15 billion tax increase over 10 years. They failed. They then tried to pass a $2 billion tax increase. They failed at that. So they've come back for one more bite at the apple, and they're calling it a transportation tax. Although, I have to ask you this. If you're a regular average person, not the kind who engages in the kind of speech that state lawmakers engage in, if somebody tells you it's a transportation tax, but then mentions to you only 6% of it actually goes to fixing roads, would you still call that a transportation tax? Welcome to Monday on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to get your calls in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. If you happen to be a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the line. As long as you come prepared to make your point as cogently and as quickly as possible, and then stick around for a few questions from me. You can also engage by taking in the X poll. We put up a brand new poll question every day of the week. Today's question, and I know this sounds absolutely crazy, but this is the way that government schools run. Should a teenage boy who brought a loaded gun to school be allowed to go back to that school? Now, my answer to that would be, of course not. And I think most of you might answer the same way. And yet, today's reporting shows the boy who brought a loaded gun to school is now going to be allowed to return to Arlington High in Washington State. The gun had a bullet in the chamber. The safety was off. The student carried an additional full magazine of rounds. The district says the matter has not yet been settled. Well, if they're letting him come back to school, I would say they've settled at least that question. Your kids will be going to class with a kid who brought a loaded, I don't know if it was cocked or not, but a bullet in the chamber, full magazine in the gun, spare magazine in the student's pocket. Parents at Arlington High School are naturally voicing some serious concerns because they learned that the student who was arrested for bringing a loaded handgun to campus could be returning to class when school resumes next week. He was charged with a felony back in February of last year. He was removed from school following the incident. But get this. They're going to spend a lot of your money on this if that student, the one who came with the loaded gun, if he does come back to class, he will be monitored by a staff member. I don't know. It kind of brings to mind maybe an assistant principal standing over his shoulder, watching him at all times. But if they mean by monitored, meaning he checks in the morning and checks out in the afternoon, we're not quite sure what monitored means. But if they're going to assign a staff member to keep an eye on one student, he will be barred from carrying a backpack. And he will be searched daily. You know, that brought a thought to mind. Do you know who is subject to those very same conditions at a school? That would be the killer, the mass murderer at Parkland High School. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High in Florida had the same conditions. Every day when he came in, he got searched. He was not supposed to carry a backpack at all. And you know what? He's the guy who came back and committed mass murder at that school under those conditions. So when the schools say, well, he won't be able to carry a backpack and he will be monitored by staff members, he will be searched daily, does that actually allay your fears? I don't think it would satisfy me. But you can find the question and shortly put, should a boy who brought a loaded gun to school be allowed to go back to that school? My answer would be no. You can answer it any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, the special session of the legislature, and I told you problem number one, as far as I'm concerned, they have their first public hearing this afternoon at 3 p.m., and then on Friday they're going to vote on whether or not to raise your taxes dramatically. They call it a transportation tax. Only 6% goes to actually fixing roads. Most of it goes for the profligate spending of ODOT. Now, that's problem number one, because when politicians want to hide something, they usually bury it in a holiday weekend, like Labor Day weekend, where many people will not be paying attention from about Thursday afternoon all the way to Tuesday morning. And in the meantime, the legislature is down there in Salem in that big white building with the gold bowling trophy on top, deciding whether or not to raise your taxes. And Willamette Week pointed out that Joe Courtwright, who you've heard on this show, he's an economist, he's a longtime advocate for transit, advocate for transportation. But he says ODOT's numbers are a bogus and deceptive sales technique. He says the U.S. Census Bureau backs him up. And what they did was a five-year analysis that shows that Oregon spends about the same, right in the middle of the other six states cited by ODOT: California, Washington, Nevada, Utah, Idaho, and Montana. They always claim to be the poor stepchild who's hidden away in the attic. They are not. They also claim, well, gas tax revenues have been dropping. That, as far as I'm concerned, is a bald-faced lie. The truth is ODOT had record gas tax revenues in 2024. Now, can you say your gas tax revenues are dropping at the time when you're showing record amounts of gas tax revenue coming in? The other problem, and it's identified by Courtwright as well, you've heard him talk about this issue on the show, is that ODOT comes in and lowballs the front end of every project. And the example that's given over and over again, the Abernathy Bridge, still not finished on I-205. They came in and told the legislature, it'll cost us $250 million. They got the first $50 million. By the time they got the first bids in, it had gone to $500 million. It had doubled. And today the price tag is at $815 million, more than four times as much, or almost four times as much as the original estimate. And the project isn't done yet, so don't count on that $815 million being the final word. And the fact is that ODOT is still putting up job postings right now for six-figure salaries. I pointed out a couple of them 2 weeks ago. Project Delivery Administrator 3, a guy or gal who pushes paper and you get to work from home remotely, salary up to $250,000 a year. Director of External Affairs, that might be a lobbyist to the legislature, salary up to $200,000 plus benefits, generous vacation, and a PERS pension. And now they're going to tell you, we're going to jack up your taxes on gasoline, on automobile registration. We plan to toll the daylights out of you if you have the temerity to actually drive down one of the freeways that you paid for with your money, and we're going to toll you for that. And they want to raise the prices even more. If anybody's in favor of that, I will be glad to take that naysayer call any single day. Glad to have you with me on a Monday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. The Northwest Nonsense is coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network.
And now, this musical message to anyone who wants to indoctrinate our school children.
Hey, teacher, leave them kids alone.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
Boy, do American liberals pick some weirdo heroes. Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who multiple judges have found was illegally present in the United States years ago, so President Trump's administration ordered him deported. Does that make sense? He's not here legally? Well, then we'll deport him. The American news media did not want to call him an illegal, so they gave him the rather clever moniker of Maryland Man because he was an illegal alien who happened to live in the state of Maryland. The Trump administration deported him to El Salvador, but once again, the liberals didn't like that because his own home country decided Kilmar belongs in prison. So Homeland Security brought him back to face human trafficking charges out of Tennessee. You can actually watch the video of the state police pulling him over with a van full of illegal aliens about 2.5 years ago. We played the audio of the exchange on the air. Those cops immediately saw what was up. You got a bunch of human trafficking going on here. And then the Biden FBI ordered the cops turn them loose. Joe Biden was the best friend of human traffickers everywhere. And by the way, over the next 18 months, we should remind every single voter, if you like human trafficking, do you? Well, then you're probably voting for a Democrat. Just a few hours ago, that very same Maryland man was taken back into custody and will be re-deported. I'll bet Garcia wishes he was getting frequent flyer miles. We're now told he's destined for Uganda, a real garden spot in Africa from what I've been told. Meantime, I'm happy to let the liberals advocate for criminal aliens and human traffickers. How do you suppose that's going to go over with the voters in next year's election? Glad to have you with me on a Monday. Glad to be back from a week off, although we spent most of the week very productively doing a bunch of construction work. So if you want to join the conversation, it's easy to do. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and you get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Brando writes in, Lars, I fully realize you might have a completely different viewpoint on this. Actually, I don't. But I came across an article after hearing an owl outside my bedroom half an hour ago, which is awesome. I've never seen one in my chicken coops. Maybe I will someday. But do you think it's an effective strategy for the U.S. government to try to save the spotted owl by slaughtering barred owls? There's a reason why certain animals do better in certain territories than others. I don't see any reason why the government could not try to create sanctuaries for the spotted owl if it's really important to them. But what if we don't do this? Nature will do it anyway. And besides, I just think a program of shooting these birds, that's kind of disgusting. I agree with you. It doesn't matter what the intent is, and I don't vote Democrat. They could just let them live and register Democrat. Imagine if it were you or me doing this, it'd be a federal crime. But when the federal government does it, it's perfectly acceptable. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about this grill a little bit later on in the show, but I want to give it today to the Evergreen School District. Why, in the Evergreen School District, unionized teachers don't even have to go on strike. The district basically goes on strike for them. And Sue wrote in about that. Lars, here we go again. School is ready to start. I've heard some bus drivers, parateachers, and other Evergreen employees are going to go on strike and delay the start of the school year. That happens every year. They've had the summer off, and when it's time to come back to work at a job they accepted and signed a contract for, suddenly they want more money and benefits at the cost of the kids. Why do they wait till the kids are back to class to go on strike? They are using the kids and hurting their education. I hope to see the day when a school superintendent has the backbone and fires them all and starts over or pulls some of their employees out of the admin building. There are too many of those to do all the teaching. Thanks, Lars, for all you do. Signed, Sue. And our best email of the day so far, but you can send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. They've done it for me, and the result is beautiful. I can tell you that. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. John in Lakewood, Washington writes in, Lars, I was listening to your interview with Jay Green from Heritage. He said the problem is dealing with Chinese spy students and it's difficult to solve. I think the problem is easy to solve. Treat Chinese students who are not citizens with extreme prejudice, or better yet still, stop allowing them into the U.S. altogether. Treat them as illegal aliens and presume their intent is to steal intellectual property. Furthermore, we should end Fulbright scholarships for PRC students and any foreign student who's coming from a country that is a terrorist or narco nation. Also, elevate these crimes, depending on the severity, to either severe felonies with long sentences or the death penalty. The solution to spying by foreign students should be simple, and it is. Signed, John in Lakewood. Hear calls now. Let's start with Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Main point is I'm going to testify at the Capitol today on that stupid bill that Kate Brown. You got to remember this, Lars. This cost me in the last 4 years $11,000 more to live. They're going to raise my cost of having a Class B CDL from $145 to renew it to $700 almost.
$700 for a CDL? Like, are you kidding me?
Yes. That's part of the bill. Plus, the governor wants to consolidate more power so she can put her people. Nobody ain't talking about that. And I called out all of my Republicans in the House and Senate. They need to stay out of that building, or they need to just do what the people ask, because I don't have the extra money. If they keep pricing at this rate, Lars, I might have to move to Idaho. I might have to move to Arizona. You know what those two states got in common? $1 a gallon less than my fuel almost.
And not only that, but they have a trend line of reducing taxes at the same time that everybody else is increasing taxes. And Ron, this is what Ben Franklin meant when he talked about laboratories of democracy. They only had 13 of them then, but imagine this. If you had anybody in any business in any city in the Northwest and say three fast food joints, and two of them are raising their price or dropping their prices, and only one of them is raising his prices at the end of the day, what's going to happen to the one who raises his prices? I hope he goes broke. The problem is when he goes broke, in the case of the state, you punish everybody who lives in that state.
Yes, sir. And the last thing I will say, Lars, your emails, people, does work. Please email. Call your senators. Call your representatives. Call the Senate and House leadership. Even blow up the governor's office. Because if we don't make a stand, we already priced out how many more jobs you're going to lose and how much more your property tax is going to jump up, upset these things.
Yep.
And yes, Lars, I would rather just not vote. They should not be in the Capitol. And the 500 jobs, they could take care of that in one throw. Get rid of those $200,000
income. Do you know, Ron, how I would solve the problem right now? They have committed money to the Rose Quarter Freeway Project. Is that project dead, Ron, yes or no?
It ain't done yet.
They haven't even started it. So that project is dead. If you set money, if you set $5,000 aside to buy a new bass boat, and then your wife says, we are not buying that bass boat, all of a sudden you have $5,000 you can spend on your actual day-to-day needs. If ODOT canceled the Interstate Bridge Project, which is dead, and the Rose Quarter Project, which is dead, and said, let's take the money we set aside and actually use
it. The Lars Larson Show. .org. People always ask Lars if he wants to run for public office, like president.
Do you know how much power I'd have to give up to be president?
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on a Monday heading up to Labor Day weekend, when the Oregon legislature plans to meet so that nobody notices that they're meeting, and they hope. I realize this sounds silly. I mean, to non-politicians, I think even Dylan Honkoop would laugh about this one. They say, I know, we'll hold our meeting over Labor Day weekend and nobody will realize what we're doing. I think that's the plan. I think we're going to make sure that nobody fails to hear about the tax increasing plans. And now I want to go to Washington State. Dylan Honkoop, of course, is with Save Family Farming. You've got actual state-funded anti-farm messages, not you, but you're complaining about those in an official complaint?
Well, what we're seeing begs the question, Lars, did our tax dollars here in Washington pay for activist videos attacking unfairly and not based on science, attacking dairy farms, accusing them of pollution and other things? That's what it appears when You see the Washington State Department of Health logo show up on activist videos. You've got to start asking questions at this point. I think it goes to what you were just talking about. Folks who honestly are getting sloppy. They're so used to being on the government dole and being able to run roughshod over the actual laws that govern this state and this nation as far as what's supposed to happen with tax dollars. They're getting sloppy. They're spending this kind of money in a way that even folks like me, you know, from the outside can see, hey, there's something wrong here. There may even be something illegal going on here. And somebody needs to investigate.
Again, it's Dylan Honkoop from Save Family Farming. So let's give some people, let's name some names. Tell my audience first, what is ELLA, E-L-L-A, all caps?
It's an activist group based in Yakima, Washington. And it's one of these community organizing social justice nonprofits, which, whatever. They have freedom of speech. They can say what they want to say, but they are governed by the laws of the state and this nation as a 501c3 nonprofit, right? There are certain political activities they cannot engage in. And so even though they're about empowering Latina leadership and action, which sounds nice and feels good, when you see them doing things potentially with state tax dollars that amount to political campaigning in some cases. I mean, as we kind of peel back the rug and find out what's underneath, it's getting more and more ugly. In fact, I had a watchdog on my radio program over the weekend, Lars, who was saying there's a lot more to this story. This is just the tip of the iceberg of what this community organizer group, EIA in Yakima, is actually up to, spending money on political campaigns and these nasty, vicious attacks on one community, the dairy farming community in Washington State.
Now, look, Dylan, look, I grew up in Tillamook. They had more cows there than people in Tillamook County, Oregon. What are they saying, that somehow there's this brand new problem created in water supplies because, you know, the southbound end of a northbound cow is going to, you know, put out some fertilizer? That's been going on for what, hundreds, thousands of years? What's the new problem they claim to have identified with cow poop?
Well, this is something that we've talked at length about before, Lars. The general accusation or even assumption that, mind you, is not supported by the science is that, well, there are dairy farms there. They have gotten bigger in that area, the lower Yakima Valley, than they were in the past. They must be the reason in these folks' minds and in their argument, they must be the reason that there are high nitrates in the groundwater in that area. When you look at the actual science, it's likely from other sources and for other reasons, but it's very convenient for them to point their finger and say these, you know, dairy farms are smelly and we want them to go away. Therefore, we're going to accuse them of contaminating our groundwater and we're going to lambast them. And also in the courtroom, to try to push them out of business and push them out of our community. And that's essentially what the game plan is of this group and other community organizing groups like this that we followed in the past.
Well, in fact, Dylan, let me ask you this. I mean, because without being indelicate at lunchtime, I want people to keep their lunches down. The cow, I do know this, they have five stomachs, but the cow eats grass at one end. It poops out the other end. So everything that is pulling up from the ground came from the ground to begin with, and then the cow isn't adding any nitrates to it. So if what comes out the southbound end of the cow is the same stuff that went in the northbound end, minus some energy that got turned into milk or meat, then how are you adding anything to that cycle? Isn't that kind of a closed loop?
That is the nitrogen cycle and the carbon cycle. You know, even if we bring in the accusations of climate change and air pollution, climate change causing pollution from cows, it's all part of the same thing. Cows eat, they turn it, you know, they create food, like you say. Their poop goes back on the field. It's not a waste. You see so many things referring to it as animal waste. No, it's a valuable fertilizer, organic fertilizer for the crops that then feed the cows and the cycle continue. So you're exactly right on. Now, mind you, if manure is not stored correctly or applied correctly, it can eventually cause problems. But that's been the focus of this legal battle now entering its second decade of accusations in court against these farms. And they've spent millions between them to protect groundwater with what they're doing with cow poop. And the reality is, in that area, the groundwater is far enough down below folks' feet there that it takes decades upon decades for anything that happens at the surface to make it all the way down to the groundwater.
And
we're looking at things that probably happened in the 60s or before that are probably the actual reason before any of these dairy farms moved into the area about 20, 30 years ago.
So how about the Washington Department of Health? Have they raised a stink about a political activist group using their logos on these videos?
We have not heard boo from them, and we filed a complaint. As the organization I represent, Save Family Farming, we complained to the Washington State Attorney General's office saying this appears untoward. Your state, you know, agency, you're the law enforcement folks there. You're in charge of these kinds of things. You're the attorney for the state. Your agency, the Department of Health, has their logo appearing on these videos. Did the State Department of Health use our tax dollars to sponsor this activist propaganda? Does the state support or endorse that message? And certainly I would imagine that, you know, we've been talking about this publicly. We've filed an official complaint. We've made public records requests. I would imagine if it was something they didn't agree to, they would immediately be calling on this group to pull that logo. But so far, we haven't heard a thing, which just creates more and more questions as
okay.
we go.
So the last name to be named, Teodoro Martinez, I'm saying that right. Who's Teodoro yes. Martinez?
He's running for the Port of Sunnyside Commission. And that's the thing, this activist group that's not supposed to be political is all mixed up in local and regional politics there in the lower Yakima Valley. Why this candidate for public office, the Port of Sunnyside, is appearing in an activist propaganda video with the Washington State Department of Health. Their logo, their potential sponsorship on this, that adds another layer of, you know, is this woman essentially campaigning on the backs of our tax dollars? Another question that needs to be answered.
And
as I said at the open, these people are lazy on this. They're used to being able to do what they want in the dark, you know, whether it's the Oregon legislature meeting on Labor Day. They're just hoping people will ignore what they're doing and get away with it.
I mean, we're saying
no more.
Can you imagine this, Dylan? They couldn't be plainer about this. She scheduled this back in July. That's, you know, Tina Kotek, and said, when should we do it? I know, over a major holiday weekend when most people are going to leave town, you would hope, by Thursday night or Friday morning, and they'll be gone till maybe Monday, maybe Tuesday. Let's make the tax increases then. That's Dylan Honkoop from the group called Save Family Farming. In a moment, if your kids are in a school with unionized teachers, they may miss some school, and it sounds like the schools are going on strike rather than the union. That's next, and your call.
Guys.
Donald Trump with a warning to Hamas at the Republican Jewish Coalition Conference.
If you spill a drop of American blood, we will spill a gallon of yours.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Can you imagine the clown show that Kilmar Abrego Garcia is? I just got word. I told you that Kilmar Abrego Garcia, one of the weird heroes of liberals and Democrats everywhere in America, he was the guy who was engaging in human trafficking. He was also in this country illegally. Multiple judges decided that. The Trump administration sends him to El Salvador, and El Salvador says, this guy's a bad guy. He's a gangbanger. They throw him in their prison. So American liberals get all crazy and excited, and they travel down to El Salvador and have margaritas with Kilmar Abrego Garcia, and they demand that he be returned to the United States. So the White House says, okay, we'll bring him back to face human trafficking charges. So they bring him back to face the human trafficking charges, and then the liberals go crazy and say, well, you can't hold this human trafficker in custody. You have to release him. So the federal government said, okay, we'll cut him loose. He's still, you know, up for the trafficking charges. And the minute they cut him loose back on the street, he was subject to deportation again. So they picked him up about 6 or 7 hours ago, and they took him into custody. But now another judge has blocked his deportation. So the same liberals who are arguing you can't hold this guy in custody on the human trafficking charges have now re-engineered him back into custody, only now he's in the custody of ICE instead of some other agency. So a judge now says you can hold him in custody, but you can't send him out of the country. This clown show is going to occupy people, and I just want people to remember, 1 year from now, when we are in late August of next year, heading up to a congressional election, I want you to remind people of the kind of folks that the Democrat Party always chooses as their heroes. Glad to have you with me on a Monday, and glad to be back from a week of break. This segment comes from 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. And our X poll today, should a boy who brought a loaded gun to school in Arlington, Washington, be allowed to go back to that school? And he didn't just bring a gun. He was actually charged with a felony crime and arrested, 14 years old. And now parents are being told, when your little darlings go back to school in a week or two or whenever they go back to school, this 14-year-old boy, the one who brought the loaded gun to school, the one with one bullet in the chamber, a full magazine and a spare magazine to boot, he's going to be back in school with your kids. And the parents are understandably upset. So should a boy who brought a loaded gun to school be allowed to go back to that very same school? I'd say no to that. You can answer in any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go first to Jason. Hey, Jason, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well,
hey,
Lars,
Jason.
I just heard. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Lars?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
You're a little loud because you're probably in a truck, but go ahead.
No, I'm in my car on my way to work. But anyways, I just heard moments ago from another gentleman that you had on your show. He said something about CDL licensing fees are going to jump to $700.
I think that's if Tina Kotek ends up getting her dream bill through the special session of the legislature, that they're going to jump, he thinks, to $700.
If that happens, Lars, just like that gentleman before me, I'm going to be forced to have to move out of state because I don't have that extra money just sitting around. So it kind of caught me off guard when I first turned my radio on to listen to your show, and I'm like, no, that cannot happen. They're going to push the entire trucking industry right out of the state is what's going to happen because the drivers cannot afford to renew their licenses at that large of a fee, you know? I'm kind of blown away by it.
That's
pretty much all I wanted to know, you know?
Yeah. Now, and I'll tell you what, I'll get some more I'm taking his, you know, because he's got a CDL, and he said he checked to see how much they were going to increase. But they're proposing increases that are already in place, and then this bill that's going to be before the legislature will propose even more. So you're looking at much higher gas taxes.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, yeah, I know. You know, what's really funny is I think it was just not too long ago they just raised our licensing, registration, and title fees already, and now they want to hit us again?
Yep.
Like, when is enough ever going to be enough, you know?
And I'm telling you, Jason, I think this is easy to understand what they could do with ODOT. And I'm not the guy who authored this. This is Joe Courtwright, The Economist. But he points out, imagine this. If you and your family had set some money aside for a vacation, $5,000 you piled up over the last year, and you got some money for your vacation. You piled up some more money. You want to buy a vacation home someday. And then you got another account, and you piled up some money there for whatever other project you're working on. And then you say, we've got immediate needs now, like buying groceries and gasoline. And your friends say, well, take some money out of your vacation account. What ODOT has done is committed hundreds of millions of dollars to projects that are already effectively dead. The Rose Quarter project, since it just lost $500 million that got cut in the One Big Beautiful Bill, that project's dead. The Interstate Bridge still doesn't have approval from the Coast Guard and has six other kinds of problems. They don't have the money for it. The project is dead. So you say to ODOT, hey, all that money is set aside for the Rose Quarter, for the, you know, the Interstate Bridge. Why don't you use some of that if you're having trouble getting money to fix the roads and plow the snow? Otherwise, stop your whining and don't increase the cost. Jason, thanks so much for the call. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. But 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Now imagine this. A man goes out and commits a cold-blooded murder. Now, how do I know that he is a cold-blooded killer? Well, because four different juries gave unanimous verdicts finding him guilty of those murders. Only now, an appeals court has simply said, we're going to overturn the verdict altogether, including a death sentence. Well, to talk about that, our regular legal expert when it comes to prosecution is former prosecutor, former DA, Josh Markey, who joins me now serving as vice president of the National DA's Association. Josh, welcome back.
Thank you. And actually, I'm no longer vice president of National DA's. It's an organization called the Oregon Truth Project, which is trying to return some sense here in Oregon. And I'm very invested in this case. The man we're talking about is a double murderer named Randy Guzik, who on a summer afternoon in 1987 broke into a home in Terrebonne outside of Bend with two of his friends and slaughtered, there's no other word for it, Rod and Lois Hauser. Two good, decent people who literally had done nothing wrong. He just wanted to see what it felt like to kill people. And as you say, he's had four separate jury trials, 1989, 1990, 1997, and 2010. And I know this because I was the prosecutor in the last four of those trials. As you pointed out, in Oregon and most states, in order to convict somebody of a death penalty verdict, there must be a unanimous verdict. So that means all 12 jurors had to say yes, actually a total of something like 4 times 48 is. So I think 114 times they said yes. It even went to the United States Supreme Court in 2001. I'm looking at the decision on my wall here. They affirmed it. And then because, of course, there is an unlimited amount of indigent defense money, we could talk about that if you like, he gets yet another lawyer, actually.
We got to get into the background of that other lawyer, but before we do what happened with that particular lawyer goes to the Court of Appeals and says, no, despite four unanimous juries deciding he is guilty and that he is is it a 3 or 4 part test that the Supreme Court laid out for the death penalty?
4 part test has been found.
And what are the four questions that the jury all have to answer yes to unanimously?
Is he not merely, was it not merely intentional but deliberate? Did the victims do anything to provoke? Is the defendant likely to commit serious acts of violence in the future? And finally, is the death penalty the only appropriate sentence? Jurors have to answer every one of those questions yes to get to that point.
You get it all unanimous. Now, let's talk about the new count, because she has a rather bizarre history, doesn't she?
She does. Her name is Karen Seal, and people who remember the incredibly bizarre story of Frank Gable, who murdered the head of the Oregon Department of Corrections back in, I think, 1989, she was thrown off the case because she was found having sex with her client up in the Metropolitan Detention Center. Now, you might think, well, a defense lawyer who's caught having sex, that must be the end of her career. Nope. Absolutely not. In fact, she married him after that, and she was, and she is now Randy Guzik's lawyer. The bar did come after her and almost disbar her 10 years ago. I sent you a copy of that for other misconduct, but none of this stuff has even been slowing her down. She's been able to get away with almost anything she wants. And their big pitch in this is so arcane, it's not worth even discussing. It would take 2 hours that basically the state literally forgot a couple commas in their 5,000 and 6,000 page response. And so the Oregon Court of Appeals, which in this case is a 3-judge panel, said this is ridiculous. And it didn't take them 1,000 pages in a 56-page decision. And what's interesting, Lars, is this is a big deal. This is the reinstatement of a death sentence against all these efforts by the liberals to basically to undercut the death sentence, with Oregonians have said they want time and time again. This discussion that we're having right now is the first news story, and this has been news for over a week.
Just so people, I know a lot of these get double, triple flipped because you say you had this, you know, this judge decided it's out, and then the next level decided it's in. So Judge Murphy said he got rid of the death penalty for this guy, right?
He did, and Judge Murphy's an interesting character.
Well,
I don't know if you even remember.
How so?
Well, about 15 years ago, I get a phone call personally from the district attorney in Linn County, who says that Murphy's wife is on the phone screaming and crying, and would I call my friend Lars Larson? I have no idea what she's talking about. I happen to, you'll chastise me, not listen that day. You had taken a bunch of calls from angry listeners down in Albany, where this guy had been a judge, because after he presided over a trial in which a young woman had been raped and a whole bunch of other terrible things, and instead of giving the bad guy the maximum sentence, he'd given, Judge Murphy had given the minimum,
yep,
a single sentence. And you appropriately called this out. This guy was over the moon. How dare Lars Larson do that? And they actually had the gall to think, even though I had nothing to do with the case, that they could basically call up people who knew me and get me to get you to dial back on the truth.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to do that even if you ask me to dial back. But so Judge Murphy throws out the death penalty sentence, and now the Oregon Court of Appeals has restored the death sentence for Randy Guzik?
That's correct. Well, they have overturned his decision. Making it more complicated is the fact that clueless Kate Brown, as we know, just before she left office, did a mass commutation of all death sentences. So it's not entirely clear whether Randy goes back on death row, which was actually dismantled, or whether he's going to be a one-person resident. The main thing for those of us who care about this case is we don't want him ever, ever, ever seeing the free light of day. And that was a real possibility with the ruling that the judge made.
I mean, because this guy just went in, and this nice couple, Rod and Lois Hauser, you described them before, honest, law-abiding, straightforward couple. And this Guzik character, based on the testimony at trial, simply said, I want to see what it'd be like to kill somebody, goes out and just slaughters them in their own home, right?
Butchers them in a particularly vicious way, and then basically takes trophies of it and brags about it to his family.
Well, can you imagine, Josh, why the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper and the other media don't want to take a look at this and say, wow, Court of Appeals ordinarily liberal and forgiving all day long is saying, nope, this guy deserves to be on death row, even if we have to have a one-man death row as the only single death row in the entire state. Josh, thanks so much. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Guy.com.
Some
solid advice from Senator John Kennedy.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I've told you that I'm always amazed by the kind of mascots that the Democrat Party, Party of Slavery, since 1829, they like to adopt these mascots. I mean, they had Michael Brown, you know, hands up, don't shoot Michael Brown. They had Trayvon Martin, who got shot to death because he attacked a man, and the man fought back in self-defense. And now they have Kilmer Abrego Garcia. And what is his story? Well, Kilmer Abrego Garcia has been in the United States for 10 years. And you know what's notable? His attorney is out telling reporters why it would be unfair for the Trump administration to send Kilmer off to Uganda, even though in Uganda, an awful lot of people know English, because he doesn't know the native language in Uganda. And you say, okay, he's been in America for 10 years, and he doesn't speak English at this point. He only speaks Spanish. How hard do you have to work not to learn the local language? If you move to a country where a different language is the predominant language, English is now the official language of the United States, thanks to Donald Trump, and it is the predominant language that is spoken in this country. And how much of a handicap is it if you move to any country? I mean, I have no plans whatsoever to ever move to any other country, not even Canada, where you have to say A at the end of every sentence. But if somehow Tina and I ended up going to, I don't know, France, Germany, someplace like that, can you imagine how hard you'd have to work to say, I am not learning that German stuff. I'm not going to learn how to speak French. I'm not going to do it. I mean, wouldn't you have at least a passing knowledge of the language after 10 years of being there? Well, apparently in Kilmer's case, no. And as I told you, just in the last hours, we've got a really weird situation. Kilmer Abrego Garcia, it was decided almost a decade ago that he was not legally in America. And yet the Biden administration allowed him to stay. And then he got stopped in Tennessee, and the cops recognized that he was in the middle of transporting illegal aliens. He was trafficking. So then the Trump administration says, we're sending this guy back to his home country of El Salvador, which they did. And then when he got to El Salvador said, this guy's a gangbanger. He's an MS-13 gang member. We're going to put him in our new shiny special gangbanger prison, and we're going to put him in there. And all the liberals got all excited, saying, you can't put him in there. Why, he's just a nice man from the state of Maryland. That's how crazy this is. So the Trump administration, fine, we'll bring him back. And they did. They brought him back to the United States and said, now that you're back in the United States, you're here to face human trafficking charges, because Joe Biden did not want to prosecute human traffickers, let alone people like Kilmer Abrego Garcia. So the Trump administration charges him. They put him in custody. He's charged with the crimes. He's going to face trial. And then some Looney Tunes judge decides, we're going to cut him loose and we're going to put him back on the streets. I think the judge knew exactly what was going to happen. The minute they cut him loose on the streets, the Trump administration said, if he's not in custody anymore, then he's merely illegally in the country. So ICE picked him up hours ago today, and they brought him back into custody, getting ready to deport him. And then another Looney Tunes federal judge decided, well, he's illegally in the country. He's facing human trafficking charges. You're getting ready to deport him to Uganda, which, by the way, under federal law, not Donald Trump policy, under federal law, any presidential administration who is in charge of immigration, and they all are, according to the Constitution, if your home country is not the place to send you, they can send you to any country on earth that will accept you. So they make a deal with Uganda, and they say, we're going to send this joker to Uganda. And a federal judge decides, no, you're not. So you've got one federal judge saying you can't hold him in custody. You got another federal judge saying we have to hold him in custody. And you got another federal judge saying, and you can't send him back to any other country, and you can't send him back to El Salvador. It's almost like that guy in the movie where the man with no country who was forced to sail the earth on a sail ship back in the day. And he didn't have any country where he actually had any kind of status. That seems to be Kilmer Abrego Garcia, hero of the Democrat Party. Glad to be with you and glad to take your calls. I'll get to calls in a second. I got a couple of stories I want to tell you about. 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Vote in our X poll. You'll find the daily poll question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, my website. So should we show leniency for an illegal alien truck driver who killed three people while making an illegal U-turn? What other kind of U-turn does an illegal alien make? They make illegal U-turns. Well, they're talking about it in Florida. Florida officials are now facing a public petition from citizens that are asking that they show leniency toward Harjinder Singh, who's an illegal alien truck driver accused of causing a crash that took the lives of three people. They now have 2.5 million signatures. I wonder how many of those are actually from Florida. As of yesterday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, the petition posted on the website change.org is addressed to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. And basically, the petition is just a statement of a point of view. It has no legally binding authority. It calls for DeSantis and the Florida Board of Executive Clemency to reexamine the case against this 28-year-old man. He is facing three counts of vehicular homicide, three counts of manslaughter in connection with a crash that happened about 2 weeks ago. Harjinder Singh, 28 years old, is an illegal alien, was operating a commercial semi-truck with a trailer on the Florida Turnpike. He allegedly attempted a U-turn in an unauthorized area. The trailer jackknifed, collided with a minivan, killed all three people in the minivan. On Saturday, a judge in Florida said, "We're not giving you bond. You're going to stay locked up for now." He said, "You are an unauthorized alien. You are a substantial flight risk." I mean, if you're looking at life in prison or life for a long, long time in or some period of time in prison, you're definitely a flight risk. I mean, I would imagine most illegals would do that. Singh crossed into the United States about 7 years ago via the southern border. He got a commercial driver's license. Where else? In California. So California was willing to give him a CDL to operate a big rig with which he allegedly killed three people. And now the Democrats are making him a hero, too? Good luck. Let's go to Bill and Lapine. Bill, welcome to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm Bill Minix. I'm the chief petitioner for the recall of Tina Kotek.
Good.
And I just wanted to thank you for your show. You've mentioned it a couple times. I want people to know that we're rocking and rolling. We're going to get this done one way or another.
And you've got an approved ballot title, and you're gathering legal signatures from registered voters so you can put this before the people?
Yes, I am. We have volunteers throughout the state working very hard, setting up pop-ups. We're putting our locations on the website. We have a huge rally coming up this weekend, Friday and Saturday, from 10 a.m., no, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. both days. We have huge
Where
speakers.
Where is it?
Go ahead.
Yeah, tell people where it is, Bill.
It's going to be at the State Capitol Mall, where the fountain is, right across from the Capitol. We have speakers, if I could tell you who a couple of them are going
to
be.
We're coming up to a break, so make it quick. You want to get people there, they'll meet the speakers at that point. But Friday and Saturday at the Capitol Mall, the state capitol in Salem. Bill, I wish you luck. It takes a lot of anger to drive a successful recall. But in this case, people might just be angry enough with Tina Kotek to say she needs to go. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Constantine Kissin on Hamas.
For years now, many of us have been warning that the barbarians are at the gates. We were wrong. They're inside. There are positives as well. I mean, say what you want about Hamas supporters. At least they know what a woman is.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I always disclose if I've got a dog in the fight. In this case, I don't particularly like unions. If you want to belong to one, okay, you can do any foolish thing you want to do. I was once forced, or a couple of times, I was forced to be a member of a union. I got out as fast as I could and managed to help decertify at least one bargaining unit. I count that as a victory. So, having said all of that, coming up on Labor Day, Should maybe the Labor Day picnics, especially the ones run by the unions, should they maybe recognize that workers should not be forced to fund union political activities that they don't support? Mark Mix joins me now, president of the Committee and Foundation for Workers. Hey, Mark, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Lars, good to be with you, and thanks for that intro, and thanks for the question about Labor Day. You're absolutely right. Should forced unionism maintain itself as the default position in American labor policy? We believe it shouldn't, but others have a different opinion.
Well, see, people call that an anti-union position on my side. I don't think of it as anti-union. If the union wants to have people join their group, they should have to go out and sell them on it the same way any other organization, whether it's the NRA or other, say, private nonprofits, want to go out and get people to join. They want everybody to join. I mean, certainly, I think the NRA represents maybe 6 or 7 million people out of about 150 million gun owners in America. So they don't even represent a majority of people who have a dog in the fight. In the case of unions, if they had to go to their members and say, it's worth giving us $1,000 or $1,200 a year because we will do all these things for you, it would actually make the unions better the same way any business is better if they know all day long that if a customer walks in and isn't happy with them, they'll walk out the door and they will take their business away. Unions should have that same kind of powerful incentive to do a great job. And if they did, I think the unions would be better off, wouldn't they?
Absolutely, Lars. And that, you know, that's the position of Samuel Gompers, known as the father of the American labor movement. In his final speech to the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, in El Paso, Texas in 1924, Gompers pleaded with the delegates of the AFL to basically continue to maintain the voluntarism that was part and parcel of the union movement. He said this: the workers of America adhere to the voluntary institutions. Anything else will destroy them. And now the private sector unions are looking at about a 5.9% density in the private sector. That's the lowest it's ever been. And I think to the point you made, Lars, it's because they don't feel like they have to compete. They don't feel like they have to provide any services to union members because they can compel them to pay or lose their jobs.
Yeah, and imagine what an arrogant position that is. In some ways, it kind of reminds me of where modern medicine is going. Because those of us who have, say, a health care plan, I've already paid the money. I mean, I've already paid the premiums. I've done all those things. When you walk in to get service, sometimes it's okay. Sometimes it's terrible. And why? Because they get your money whether they make you happy or not. So if you walk in and they say, go sit in that chair in the waiting room and we'll get with you in 5 or 6 hours, any private business that did that to its customers, they'd all leave because there's an alternative. But if you've already paid the money to the healthcare institution, they can say, we don't care. You've already paid the tab. If you walk out the door early, you just forgive us of the work we have to do. So what should union members be thinking about as they head into Labor Day weekend about what their union owes to them?
Yeah, well, what their union owes to them is accountability. And when you have forced unionism where you, just as you described, you paid the money up front and there's nothing you can do about it, or you lose your job if you don't pay, they should be demanding accountability, whether it be political or ideological accountability, or accountability in negotiating contracts on the shop floor. Right now, because of the compulsion written into federal law going back to the 1930s, union officials have a unique privilege and unique power, frankly, to basically do whatever they want, because the only choice that a worker in a non-right-to-work state, the 24 states that still allow forced unionism, is either pay up or be fired. That's not a secret. That's not a recipe for success, Lars, as you already pointed out, for a private organization. And these are private organizations. So union members and workers across the country that are thinking about union membership, they ought to be demanding accountability, and union officials ought to be giving those workers accountability by saying, look, we'll do this great service, you'll pay us, and if you don't like what we're doing, hold us accountable. That doesn't happen right now.
Well, and the thing is, Mark, I've got a brother-in-law who works in the trades, construction trades. I've got a lot of friends who work in the trades, and I say to them, are most of the guys and gals you work with conservative? Oh, yeah, we're conservative all day long. I said, then why do you let your union give all that money to the Liberal Democrats? And they say, well, there's nothing we can do about it. I said, you're a member of the union. Can't you go to a meeting and say, hey, I'd like at least half our money to go to Republican candidates if you're going to make political donations at all? Or maybe stop making the political donations whatsoever and give the extra money back to your members. Cut the dues down and take all the political contributions out. If they did one of the two of those and made an issue and said, if you don't agree with us, you know, to the union bosses, why don't we put it to a vote? See how many guys or gals who are sitting here in a group of construction workers want to vote to give money to Kamala Harris or Gavin Newsom or the likes of that. And you say, if you don't get a yes vote, then you can't give them the money, or at least give a proportional amount of money to Republican candidates. Or, as I said, my preferred alternative would be get the unions out of politics altogether.
Yeah, indeed. And no other case study needed than the 2024 elections, Lars, when union PACs gave, for every $1 that union PACs gave to Donald Trump, Kamala Harris received about $270.
Wow.
So the ratio was 99.49%, I think, is my math. I'm a government school graduate, so my math may be a little bit off, but it's pretty close. But the bottom line is this, and if you remember, Lars, I think we probably talked about this, or you certainly did, the Teamster boss, Sean O'Brien, put out an internal poll of Teamster members, and he was shocked to find out. I think they had to do two polls because the first result was so overwhelming they had to do it again to be sure. And it's something like 62% of the Teamsters said, we support Donald Trump. But yet the Teamster bosses sent money to Kamala Harris. The Teamster bosses decided not to endorse anyone because endorsing a Republican or Donald Trump, you know, from the insider perspective of union officials, not rank and file workers, to your point, but union officials here in Washington, D.C., would have been outraged. There would have been marches on the Teamsters headquarters if Teamsters had endorsed Donald Trump. We've seen that play out in other circumstances like that. But to your point, the rank and file workers in the private sector, we believe the exit polls show, and I think the polls do show, that a majority of union households, a majority of union members voted for Donald Trump, not because he was for more forced unionism, but because he was for common sense, practical ideas like securing the border, keeping boys out of girls' shower rooms, lowering taxes, reducing regulation. That's why common sense Americans voted for Donald Trump, not because he supported forced unionism.
I'm talking to Mark Mix. And Mark, imagine being told, you give us your money, you pay for the big fat salaries of all the people at the top of the union, and we're going to give your political donations to people you wouldn't vote for on a bet. And then saying, right, and we represent you. I mean, I think that is so insulting. And the union members are smart enough to be able to say to their leadership, you're either going to donate to the candidates we support. If two-thirds of us support Donald Trump, give two-thirds of the money to Donald Trump. Can you imagine what a sea change that would make at the next election if two-thirds of a bunch of the, maybe not all of them, but the UAW and these other unions, if two-thirds of their donations went to the next conservative candidate running for Congress or conservative candidate running for president? Imagine what a change that would be, and it would starve the Democrats of the very lifeblood of the Democrat Party, which is taking money from people who don't vote for Democrats, but the unions strip it out of their paychecks and then hand it off to the Democrats. Mark, thanks very much. I appreciate you calling in. Glad to have you with me. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And as always, if you're a naysayer, we put naysayers right to the front of the line. Coming up on the Radio Northwest Network, something else to thank President Trump for in the Northwest. No grizzly bears coming anytime soon to some of the North Cascades. I'll dig into the details of that and get to your calls in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Well,
Ronald Reagan knew better. Do you?
All of it began the first time some of you who know better and are old enough to know better let young people think that they had the right to choose the laws they would obey as long as they were doing it in the name of social protest.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Our ex-poll question today, and we post a brand new poll question every day. Should a boy, a teenager, 14 years old, who brought a loaded gun to school be allowed to go back to that school? We're talking about the boy, not named, but he was going to Arlington High School in Arlington, Washington. He was charged with a felony in February of last year, so about a year and a half ago. He was removed from school following the incident. Parents in the Arlington High School District are now being told that he will be coming back to the high school. But the school, and see if you find this reassuring, they said if the student does return, and I'm glad there's an if in front of that because maybe he won't, he will be monitored by a staff member, he will be barred from carrying a backpack, and he will be searched every day. And if those sound like familiar kinds of conditions, they were the same kind of conditions that were in place that were applied to the young man who ended up committing mass murder at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Yeah, he committed murder anyway, despite all those precautions. So should a boy, a teenager who brought a loaded gun to school, one bullet in the chamber, a full magazine and a spare magazine to boot, should he be allowed to go back to school? I would say no to that. You can find the X-Bull today at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Let's go to Mike, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I just wanted to comment on the Florida man that killed the three people in the minivan. I encourage a lot of people to go and look at that on YouTube because it gives you the dash footage. Obviously, he's got a camera that goes both ways, and a lot of these trucks, they do, so they can watch you, your company watches you, and, of course, watches the road. It shows that accident in great detail. I'm not somebody that looks up snuff films or anything, but as a truck driver, you can see three people died instantly. And the look on that guy's face was ice cold and, in my opinion, okay, it's just my opinion, yeah, absolutely zero remorse and didn't even get excited. His passenger, who was riding shotgun, that guy obviously knew something big had just happened. He got jumpy. And it's just disturbing. And I'm not an expert, but that should be vehicular homicide. Years ago, I had a friend that got vehicular assault because he was drunk driving, T-boned a gal and broke her pelvis. Now, she didn't die, thank God. But he did get a vehicular assault, which is a felony. And
well, by the way, just so people know, Mike, the man, this guy, yep, Singh, the driver, is up on, yes, three counts of vehicular homicide, three counts of manslaughter. So he's got both, and the jury's got the choice.
Okay.
But let me ask you something. You've watched the video. It appears that the driver was looking in his side mirrors and not looking, yep, at what was right dead in front of him, correct?
Well, so he was in the middle of the U-turn,
yep,
which again is, I don't know if you know or not, but that is illegal,
yep,
on an interstate to do that with a commercial truck. So he is basically, the look on his face was, he looked like any of us are driving, you run over a 6-inch curb and you go, it must have been a curb. He's looking in the mirror and you watch that minivan just hit him. So basically he's got that trailer going across that lane.
Yep.
That when the minivan hits it, it's just ahead of the wheels on the trailer, and I mean, boom, done.
And just crushes the car, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, and you can see the truck rock. So I'm assuming, empty or loaded, you would feel something like that because it looked like big speed. You know, I mean, I don't know what their speed is in Florida, but I would guess 70, 75, kind of like Idaho and stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I want to jump back to where he got his CDL. So he comes in illegally in 2018, 7 years ago. At,
yeah,
some point between,
yeah,
then and now, he gets his CDL. How does somebody get a CDL when they're on the books as not legally in the country?
You know, and that's a really good question because, as you know, and most of your listeners, the CDL program is federal.
Yep.
This isn't necessarily state to state. Okay, my assumption is he had a translator for the class, or he backdoored it and paid for a CDL. That's not out of the question.
No, it's not. And even though it's a federal license, each one is issued by the individual state. So I think some of that falls on, say, the states like California and Washington State that authorize that CDL. Let's go to Gene. Hey, Gene, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. So I'm calling about Mr. Singh. I've done a lot of research on him individually and how he obtained his CDL, originally from Washington State. He went to a school that's now defunct, had their license of the school revoked because they've been accused of paying examiners.
Being paid, or paying the examiners to clear the students.
Paying the examiner, yep. Correct. So originally Mr. Singh got his CDL through a school out of Washington State. Washington State issued the CDL originally. Then he went to California and got a non-domicile CDL, which means he's not a resident, but they gave it to him anyway.
Yep. And those kind of holes in the system can be absolutely deadly. Gene, thanks for the call. Glad to have you with me. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com. To sell your home instantly and guaranteed, go to NickShivers.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson.
Alan Bonus.
Gentlemen, you ready for the bid show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I know that you know that I support Donald Trump. But I will tell you one thing. When he's done with his second term in office and he's made America so much better, so much greater, he should not be getting a pension. And he shouldn't be getting most of the perks that former presidents get. Now, maybe back in the day when you had Mamie Eisenhower, who was on very, very, I think, as I understand, some very thin money to be able to live on. When you're talking about leaving somebody in poverty, okay, we'll take care of that. But former presidents now are almost uniformly phenomenally rich. So should those phenomenally rich people be getting multi-hundred-million-dollar benefits paid for by the taxpayers? I would argue no. In fact, I've even argued they should not get a pension. They shouldn't get an office paid for. If they want to raise a bunch of money and have a library, even one as ugly as the one that Barack Hussein Obama is having built for himself as a big monument to Barack, as far as I'm concerned, it looks the way it should. It's a very ugly building because he is a very ugly politician. But I'll leave all that aside and talk to Damian Brady, who is Vice President of Research for the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. Damian, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for having me on. You know, a lot of people are just not aware about these perks that former presidents get when they leave office. So it's ripe for reform, especially with President Trump in the White House.
Can I try my favorite reform idea for you? I would start with all the pensions, and I would put a safety net in. I said if there's ever a president whose annual income falls below, pick a number, 50,000, 100,000. So you got a former president living in a refrigerator box down by the river, you know, eating cat food out of a can. No, we're not going to do that. But until they drop below $100,000 or a certain amount of net worth, they shouldn't be getting a single pension at all. Do you think that we could get Americans to buy into that idea that these folks like the Obamas that are worth tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, even George W. Bush, people like that? National taxpayers has counted up quite a bill that American taxpayers have paid in the last 25 years, haven't you?
Yeah, we found that on average we're spending about $5 million a year to provide these perks for former presidents. So that includes pensions that they get and then funding for an office space and personnel to staff that office and then money for phones and printing and equipment. They also have a benefit for travel, but in general, most former presidents are not taking advantage of that. And I also need to note that this figure excludes anything to do with security protection. That's all off the books. We have no idea what is being spent on that from the Secret Service.
No, because they're going to tell you, we can't tell you how much because that might give somebody an idea of how thick or thin somebody's security is. But it's certainly a considerable amount of money. If any time a former president wants to be able to take a trip, if he's entitled to call the Secret Service and say, I'd like some agents to go with me, then you're paying them plus their travel, plus their hotels, plus, it can add up to quite a bill. But, for instance, you cite that Joe Biden is getting an annual congressional pension that's $166,000 a year on top of the tens of millions of dollars that he and his family have earned. And probably, I don't know what his book deal turned out, but they're already phenomenally wealthy. Do they need that kind of dough coming from the taxpayers?
No, they don't. And, you know, we got through the Republic and didn't have this benefit until the late 1950s. And it was passed because it was believed that Harry Truman, out of the White House, was down on his luck financially.
Okay.
So they said we need to protect the dignity of the office because there are some responsibilities that will linger on for a president after they leave the White House. So that was the justification for providing the office expenses, but then the pension was added as well. But then this was all sort of built on a fabrication because once Harry Truman's widow's papers were made publicly available in the last couple of years, it turns out he has significantly more wealth than was known at the time. So, you know, maybe if that information was available, we wouldn't have this perk available today. And in the modern era, as you've noted, former presidents leave the House, the White House, with so many opportunities to make money in the private sector. So we should find some relief for taxpayers here and put a cap on these.
In fact, to put a point on it, do you remember when Hillary Clinton famously or infamously said, when we left the White House, Bill and Hillary Clinton, we were dead broke? Now, I don't know what qualifies as dead broke for the Clintons. I have a feeling it would make most people blush to know how much they consider dead broke is. But I don't know what their current net worth is. I'm guessing it's in the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. And so why are we worried about them? They're taking care of themselves just fine. And like I said, I'd even be willing to say there's a safety net. If somebody really falls on hard times, his book doesn't sell or her book doesn't sell, and they're really on, you know, they're in danger of ending up, you know, just penniless somewhere. Okay, fine. Bail them out at that point, but not until.
Yeah, and do we really need to be providing them office space?
No.
in perpetuity for their lifetime? It's that's one of the biggest components here because there's no restriction on where the office can be located. There's no restriction on the size of it or, you know, a cap on the lease agreement amount. So, and they also tend to locate their former offices in the same location or very nearby where they have their foundation. So that creates some issues for taxpayers. Are we really just, you know, funding their other activities?
Well, and by the way, Damien, what I always think of is I know they have these offices and I know they answer correspondence and all that, but how much of that sounds like entertainment? Where a citizen says, hey, I'm going to write a letter to George W. Bush. I'm going to write a letter to Bill Clinton. And it's not Bill Clinton answering it. It's some young man or young lady in an office somewhere with an auto pen, no doubt with an auto pen, writing a letter back. So, in other words, to entertain the relatively small number of citizens who might choose to write to a former president after the former president leaves office, and then they get a reply back and they can show it to their friends and say, hey, look, I wrote to Bill Clinton and he wrote back or his office wrote back. To me, that sounds like just window dressing, doesn't it?
That's an excellent point. I hadn't thought about that. And then also, this is probably how they're getting their speaking engagements booked. And those pay a pretty penny every time they go out and make a speech, too. So, you know, are we subsidizing this? The taxpayers don't really need to be subsidizing millionaires. This is, like I said, area ripe for reform. And reform has been passed before, back in 2008, basically unanimously in the House and the Senate. And then President Obama vetoed it 3 months before he was set to leave the White House because it was going to cut off the benefits he was just about to get. So if we had the same thing happen now and we sent it to President Trump, he would sign it instantly.
Oh, I think he would. And I think he's going to turn down the office and say, if I want to run an office, I'll run it on my own dime and my own time. But if you're, and I think Obama's making a few $100,000 a speech. So if he gives even 10 speeches a year, you know, takes November and December off and does a speech a month and probably includes in it first class air travel, nice hotel, room for his staff, plus the speaking fee, plus, plus, plus. And you say, if you're getting all that, $3 or $4 million a year, 300,000 times 10 speeches, you can darn well pay for your own secretary. But if the taxpayers are doing it, I'm sure they're willing to take that kind of grift. That's Damian Brady, who is a vice president for research at the National Taxpayers Union Foundation. Damian, thank you very much for the time. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And coming up, we're going to talk about cashless bail and Donald Trump's efforts to get rid of it altogether.
Lars has welcomed naysayers for 27 years, but occasionally...
Who is this person who speaks to me as though I needed his advice?
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to talk about cashless bail in just a moment, but I'm curious what callers have on their minds. Glad to have you with me. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go right to the head of the line. Haven't had a good one yet today. And you can also send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our X poll. We put up a brand new poll question out of the news of the day. You can always find it at Lars Larson Show on X. You can find it. You can find it as well at LarsLarson.com, our website. Let's go first to Jeff. Hey, Jeff, thanks for listening. What's on your mind?
One of the most memorable things my dad ever said was during the 60s when the riots were happening and kids were burning the American flag. My dad and his best friend were sitting there watching it, and his best friend said, "Is this what the hell we went and fought and bled for?" And my dad told him, "Yes, it is."
Well,
freedom of expression. They fought for the right to burn the American flag in protest. And now it's against the law to burn or tear the Israeli flag also?
That's not a law. That is a federal judge's ruling from earlier this year.
Where did he get off make a ruling like that?
Well, judges hold on, Jeff, do you want to answer that question?
He said it's a racial hate crime.
He said it's comparable. It's comparable, and I think the judge is wrong, and it's just a, you know, remember, we have hundreds and hundreds of federal judges, and lately they've been coming up with some of the most cockamamie rulings you'd ever want, and I have a feeling that on appeal, they're going to say no. But what he ruled was he said, due to the Star of David being on the flag, that damaging...
It's not racial. It's not racial. Jews are not a race.
Nor Jeff. Jeff, you want to listen for a moment?
I can't become Irish.
Listen for a moment, okay? What the judge said was he compared it. If you call a black person by the N-word, is that racial?
Depends.
It does? Well, I guess in some ways it does, because black Americans are allowed to use the word as a familiar term with their friends. So you're right about that, technically.
I was called the N-word by a black kid.
I don't think I've ever been called the N-word, although I have friends who are black who've occasionally used the word, although it's ugly. But all he didn't say it was racial. What he said was he compared it to racial slurs against black people. But this judge, let me tell you how far off base I think he is, Jeff, because I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a judge. He had to go back to the Civil Rights Act of 1866 to say it's like that. And that's all he said was he didn't say it is racial. He just said it's comparable to that. I don't agree with him. And as I told you, Jeff, how often on this show do you hear us talking about federal judges who rule one thing or another and they get overruled as soon as it hits the Court of Appeals? So don't assume that when this judge makes this ruling that it may not last 10 seconds. I mean, it may get appealed immediately. Well,
I got another one for you real quick.
Okay. All right. Real quick.
Okay. There's politicians that want to have the Americans that are going over and fighting for the IDF. They want to have National Guard like protections regarding a job. And another congressman.
I'm not sure what that means.
There's another congressman that wants to give them the same benefit, VA benefits, that our soldiers get for fighting for this country.
No.
They're mercenaries. They're not soldiers.
Well,
they're
in fact, Jeff, you are aware that if the in the United States, and again, I'm going to cite from memory what the law is. Let's say you want to go and fight in a foreign conflict. You know,
you're a mercenary.
Yes, you are. But you, listen, it is strictly illegal under federal law for you to do that unless you have the sign off of the federal government, because our government decided a long time ago we don't want to have people coming here from here and acting as mercenaries in foreign conflicts. If America's involved, then we're involved. If we're not involved, individual citizens cannot choose to go off and do it on their own. I believe that's exactly what the federal law says. But I get your point. But let me ask you something else. There are a number of kinds of free speech. Are you allowed to threaten the president of the United States?
It depends on what kind of threat.
No, it does not. It is strictly against the law. If you made that kind of threat, we'd dump your call hotter than a hot, fat quicker than a hot potato, because it is illegal. Now, is threatening a former president a matter of free speech? I think if you fought it on First Amendment grounds, you might actually win. But most Americans have simply said, yeah, we shouldn't be threatening current or former presidents or vice presidents or secretaries of state or their families. And that's in the federal law right now. There were a lot of federal laws under Biden that just never got enforced. But let me ask you this. Is Trump right when he says, I have an executive order, I want to make it punishable by up to a year in jail if you burn an American flag?
That's so wrong. That's King Donnie overstepping himself. We have freedom of expression.
King Donnie?
Protest. King Donnie. That's right. He's King
Donnie,
baby.
So what message is it you're conveying if you burn an American flag? That you hate America?
No, you're burning your protest of what America is doing.
Well, what we're doing? You mean the whole country or just the federal government or just the state government or just President
Trump? America is representing and doing in its name.
So you're okay. You're okay with saying we will not make it something punishable by a year in jail for burning an American flag. See, I think they ought to prosecute them under arson law.
Hell no, because that's the way that you dispose of a tarnished flag, is by burning it.
Yeah, except that, Jeff, you are really being a ding-dong in that, because I went through Boy Scouts. There is a proper way to dispose of an American flag by burning it. Not you
by
don't dump
burning.
It. But hold on,
by
but
folding,
stop. You know what, Jeff,
burning,
if you want to say by
way.
Burning four or five more times, go ahead. But my point is that when you do it as a way of properly disposing an American flag, is that what those protesters in the streets are doing? That they are properly and respectfully disposing of a damaged flag? It's not what they're doing, and you know it. So you're just trying to find an excuse to object to something President Trump is doing that I have a feeling an awful lot of Americans are going to say, yeah, burning the flag, that ought to be illegal. And Jeff says, no, we should. That's free speech. OK, you're entitled to your opinion. Let me mention cash bail. So the Constitution says that unless you're accused of murder, every person accused of a crime is entitled to have bail set. Now, they don't say it has to be low. They merely say, other than murder, every single crime has bail. What the Democrats have been pushing for the last 7 years anyway, is to get rid of bail altogether. In other words, a judge who's got an accused criminal standing in front of him who's engaged in violence simply lets the person go without posting any bail or security at all. And oftentimes, those same criminals go right back out because they've been freed on their own recognizance, and they commit more violent crimes against Americans. I think that needs to end. So the president plans to sign, I think he's already signed it, he did it this morning. He signed an executive order ensuring that cashless bail is eliminated for criminals arrested in Washington, D.C. He can't do that to the rest of the country, but he can say, if you're held on a criminal charge, you are not going to get out on your own recognizance. You're going to have to post some bail. And that bail, the primary purpose of it is to make sure you show up for court. And if you start telling the criminals, hey, you can be accused of a crime, and they'll let you walk right out the door and you can go out and commit more crimes, I think most Americans are against that kind of thing. Glad to be with you on a Monday, and glad to take your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you've got the Radio Northwest
Larson Show.
New plan of action. Just mug all the Dems.
I got jumped like 5 weeks ago walking home in New York City. And when I woke up, I genuinely felt like a different person. Because I was on the floor, I was bleeding, I was concussed, and I was 100% Republican.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And interest rates concern me, not because I'm buying a new pickup truck. I'm not. Not because I'm buying a house, and I'm not, but because I realize how much interest rates have an effect on everything around us, from the cost of goods, the cost of operating a business, the cost of buying a house or buying a vehicle, things like that. And, of course, the big focus is on Jerome Powell at the Fed. So I thought we'd talk about it with Phil Kirpin, who's principal, one of the principals at Unleash Prosperity. Phil, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, great to be with you.
So should we, and I want to talk about the point you make about banks hoarding money, but are we headed for an interest rate cut, and will it be enough to actually make a difference, and should it be happening now like President Trump wants, or at some point in the future like Jerome Powell seems to want?
Well, I think we're going to get that quarter point cut, that 25 basis point cut at this next meeting in September. They've been telegraphing it all year. And Powell basically in his speech in Jackson Hole kind of said, you know, yeah, the inflation numbers and everything are the same place they've been all year, but this time we're actually going to do it. We're going to cut. And so I think at this point, if they didn't follow through on it, it would be a really big negative for markets. And so I think they're finally going to deliver a little bit of rate relief. But in my opinion, really nothing has changed from where we were last year, and they had two big cuts other than the president and the politics of it. And so I think it's long overdue, and I think it'll be some welcome relief. The cost of capital will go down. I think we're going to see, you know, the markets cheered a lot on Friday when he gave that speech. So I think it's good news. The only thing I would caution, Lars, is that we're not necessarily going to see mortgage rates come down or other sort of long-term rates, because those depend more on inflation expectations. And that's kind of on Congress to cut spending if we want to see those rates come down. And so we're going to have to see what they are able to accomplish with this second reconciliation bill and so forth before we actually see long-term rates come down.
But it's, well, on that note, when Congress gets back to business, and I don't think there was any reason for them to take August off, they have air conditioning in Washington, D.C. now, why aren't we seeing one rescission bill after another? I think you and I could sit down and say, here's $10 billion we could cut, or 20 or 30 or 40, and you could start just having a series of them. They had success with the one big beautiful bill. They had success with one rescission bill. Then why is it all the folks in official Washington are saying, well, we'll get to another one sometime next year? How about right now?
Well, glass half full way to look at it is at least they succeeded in passing the one rescission bill as opposed to crashing and burning, which looked like it might happen there for a little bit. And they've shown that they've now shown that they can in fact cancel spending that's already been approved, and that was the first time that's ever been done. So that was very significant. But I don't know why we haven't seen the sequel yet, and why they had to leave town for vacation and all of that. I agree with you; they should be cutting spending every day, or at least forcing votes on it and making it clear to the American people who's refusing to cut spending. And, you know, we're going to get we've got a few major confrontation points coming in the fall on federal spending. Not
what
just
are they going to be?
Potential additional rescission bills, but the funding for the next fiscal year, which, remember, the current fiscal year ends at the end of September, so you're going to have something to fund the next fiscal year, and we may have another reconciliation exercise with substantial spending cuts and reforms if the Speaker is serious about that, and I've learned not to underestimate him, so we may see some progress on that, but that's what it's going to take to bring down long-term interest rates, in my opinion. Fed cuts are not necessarily and do it on their own. We need to see Congress cut spending.
I mean, maybe I shouldn't be so churlish about things like this. Well, one big beautiful bill was smaller than it would have been otherwise, which is kind of not the point. The point is we're still overspending by, is it still close to about $2 trillion a year the federal government is overspending its income?
Yep.
So if you're, I mean, I always imagine this because, you know, forgive me, and I know they're not exactly comparable, but if you had a son or daughter who made $4,000 a month, and they said, but they spend $6,000 a month. They got a nice car, a nice apartment. They go out every Friday night. And mom and dad sit down with you and say, look, you're making $4,000, you're spending $6,000. You can't do that. And the son or daughter says, I'll tell you what, I'll cut out $100 of expenses. And you say, you're still $1,900 underwater. If you look at it that way and you say, I have a federal government that's overspending by about one-third, depending which way you look at it, they're either overspending by 50% or they're spending too much by 30%. Either way, it's a lot of money, and you can't be chipping away at it $10 or $20 billion at a time, can you?
Well, look, everything helps directionally. I mean, look, we are in a much better place in terms of economic growth right now because we did get the tax cuts passed. We have a much better regulatory environment. We have a much better energy environment. So if we can get a little bit of discipline, a little bit of downward pressure on spending, we don't even necessarily need to get real cuts, although you and I would love to see them. But if we can just limit the increases going forward while we're growing that denominator, then the debt becomes manageable and inflation expectations come down and long-term interest rates come down. And so this is doable. Unfortunately, what historically happens is you get the economy growing faster and government spending grows faster.
Yep.
And so you don't get any discipline at all on it.
No, and I want you to explain to my audience what you mean by the Fed effectively paying banks not to loan money. What is that?
Well, the Fed now pays interest on excess reserves, which is actually, they don't even use the word excess anymore. They pay interest on reserves that are held at the Fed. And so the banks have an enormous amount of money, about $3.3 trillion that is parked at the Fed, and they get interest on it. They get interest on that money at 4.4% annual rate. And that's kind of become the most important policy instrument of the Fed, more so than the interest rate they set on interbank lending, because that enormous amount of money, you know, the banks, if you can get 4.4% from the Fed, totally zero risk, you're not really going to do much lending in the private sector unless you've got an opportunity to make more money than that. And so what's happened is the Fed has financed a lot of government spending, huge expansion of the money supply, but then they've sort of walled that money up inside their own reserves by paying interest on it, which is a huge expense to taxpayers, by the way. Until they started doing this, the Federal Reserve used to operate at a profit and send money to the U.S. Treasury every month. Now, because they're paying so much money to the banks in interest, they operate at a loss every single month. And so they don't send any money to the Treasury anymore.
And yet all the Federal Reserve governors still make tons of money. I mean, they still make very good money. What would happen, practically speaking, if the Fed said, we paid $186 billion to the banks to not lend? If they stopped that or cut that in half, what would there be a downside to that other than the bank would suddenly find itself with a big pile of money that they're not making money on, and they might actually want to loan it out to either business or individuals?
Yeah, I mean, they would certainly look, I mean, if you've got $3.3 trillion that is sitting at the Fed that the banks notionally own, but they're not lending to anyone, nobody can get access to, they're just collecting interest from the Federal Reserve, and now the Fed says, hey, you know, we're going to cut that 4.4%, we're going to cut it, say, you know, to 4% or to 3.5%, or eventually, or they could even announce, you know, we're going to phase this down to zero, like it was, you know, before they started doing this, something like, you know, during the financial crisis, I think it was when it started, which is almost 20 years ago now, 18 years ago now. If they said that, then, you know, the banks have to look at their business plan and say, wait a second, now we've got to find other places to get return on this money. We can't just park it at the Fed and get free money.
Yeah, but when they did that, that would make money more plentiful, you know, for lending, and presumably that would bring rates down, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think it definitely would be a huge positive for the economy in terms of availability of capital to the private economy. And, you know, the only question would be, you know, can you do it in kind of a controlled way that you don't create a flood of money and, you know, another bulge of inflation? But I think they should be trying to create a glide path to get away from paying interest on reserves.
Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't we cut or enforce all the work requirements on all the people on social welfare, the childless, able-bodied adults who should be working, not the elderly, not kids, not people with kids, and say, go out and get a job. And then when you get a job, you'll have some money to buy more goods, and you can buy all the goods that are being produced, and we don't have a problem with inflation. That's Phil Turpin with the Unleash Prosperity Group. Phil, thanks very much. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. It's Monday. It's Honestly Provocative Talk for the Pacific Northwest. Wells.
Did you know Lars has a face for radio?
He's hideous!
Want to see? Follow him on Instagram at The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's honestly provocative talk for the Northwest on the Radio Northwest Network. This segment of the show always brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, Oregon Medical Centers. And my first naysayer of the day, because you know we love naysayers, 866-439-5277. Hey, John, you're a naysayer. Welcome. Thanks for calling. What do you and I disagree about today makes you a naysayer?
Well, I thought I might be able to change your feelings about cashless bail.
Okay.
And the main problem I have was it wasn't applied equally. I think every one of the January 6th petitioners should have gotten cashless bail. Do you disagree?
Not necessarily. On some of the more serious charges where assault was charged, probably not. But on the lesser stuff, the trespass or unauthorized presence in a federal building, they should have all been bailed out. Or they should have had a sensible judge say, okay, I'm setting bail at $1,000, post 10%, you're out the door. $100, you post the money, you show up on time for your court appointment, you get your $100 back, no big
because
deal.
It seems like cashless bail is only applied to non-mega people. If you're a mega person, you're lucky to get due process. I mean, if you have to shoot a Antifa rioter that's threatening your life, I don't even think you should have to face a court.
Well, you shouldn't if the prosecutor looks at the case and the police look at the case, as they did with Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, and say there is no crime committed here. It was self-defense. That one should have been washed out. And by the way, John, I really want to mention, do you know who the attorney general in Florida was at the time when George Zimmerman shot Trayvon Martin, killed him because he was being attacked by Trayvon? The local police said this was self-defense, no crime. They handed it to the prosecutor, local prosecutor. He looked at it and said, there is no crime here. And then black activists came in and said, no, we want a special prosecutor to be sent in. It was Pam Bondi who sent that special prosecutor down and put George Zimmerman through three kinds of hell and 2 years until a jury finally cleared him.
I cut her some slack because do you recall when at the Boston Massacre, the soldiers were defended.
But we're not talking about the Boston Massacre. Tell me a good reason why Pam Bondi, now seen as a conservative hero because she's AG for Donald Trump, why would she send a special prosecutor down when the police say there was no crime? Prosecutor said there was no crime. We had Dershowitz look at the charging document. He said there isn't enough in here to even find probable cause. Why did she say yes instead of saying no? We don't need a special prosecutor. No crime was committed. Move on.
Maybe she found the error of her ways.
Yeah, maybe so, but I don't know. I still think she ought to explain that one. Let's go to Tom. Hey, Tom, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Well, I was listening to your interview with the flag burner lover, and it reminded me in 1976, Rick Monday was at Dodger Stadium playing for the Cubs, and some fans ran out on the field and tried to light an American flag on fire. And he ran out and grabbed the flag from underneath of him and then ran it over to the dugout. And, you know, he never had Hall of Fame numbers, but I think he should be in the Hall of Fame just for that.
I think so, too. And, in fact, Tom, I get people's point. They say, well, this is a matter of expression. You know, can we have any things that are protected? As I said, the current law that says you can't threaten a president, I don't want that to be legal. But do I think that law is constitutional? Probably not. But most Americans don't object to saying we shouldn't have people, even with their mouth, expressing the thought that, you know, physical harm should come to a current president. I never expressed that about Joe Biden, didn't do it about Barack Obama, certainly wouldn't do it about Donald Trump. Could we have some things like the symbol of our country that is protected from that? Or is it very important for First Amendment principles that we actually allow people to do that? I appreciate the call, by the way. Let's go to Amy. Hey, Amy, thanks for listening on KVI in Seattle. What's on your mind?
Hey, I was calling regarding the guy that said King Donnie, and I wanted to direct the left-leaning people that listen to your show to a website called Royal.uk, literally the British crown. If you type in the Great Reset and King Charles, you will find that the author of the leftist agenda supporting the triangle trade, which profited the British Empire very greatly, is none other than King Charles. And we should remember that a lot of governments have used the environment to control the populace, from toss a virgin in a volcano, which I've tried to get several senators, like Senator Kennedy, he's got a great sense of humor in Louisiana, to sponsor a bill for that, or let's cut out the heart of young men on an altar. But a lot of these groups that are sound well-meaning, Pol Pot had an environmental movement called Year Zero. They're not really even changing the words.
In Cambodia. You're right. Good. Amy, thanks for the call. Let's go to AJ. Hey, AJ, what's on your mind on this fine Monday?
Yes, my good friend. Mr. Lars, I listen to you all the time and I appreciate what you do, but you made a mistake on that.
What a goof.
On that Indian that killed the three people in the illegal U-turn down in Texas?
Yeah.
You said that California issued a CDL. California actually issued a limited CDL. State of Washington gave him a permanent CDL.
I thought I mentioned that he got his first CDL in Washington, then he went to California and leveraged the Washington one for one in California, right?
Well, if you said that, I did not hear that, and I apologize.
Okay. No worries. No, I'm glad. You know, I want people to understand exactly what was going on there. The bottom line is that guy had a CDL. That guy was illegally in my country. That guy is now accused of homicide in the deaths of three American citizens. He never should have been on the road in any kind of vehicle whatsoever. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson